If you haven't already, explore the many ways to connect with our show. Watch full uncut conversations on YouTube, gain AIA-approved continuing education credits through Arcademy, and make sure to check us out and follow us on social media at Detailed Podcast. This is an original podcast by RCAT. Try the number one most used website for finding building product information and save time and money. No registration is required with RCAT, so try it today and get ahead on your next project. Visit RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com.
We have to put a design facade on it, and that's sort of where the architect comes in, is what does that design facade look like, feel like, respond to, act like, et cetera.
I mean, I think that's one of the challenges, is we still have to make really beautiful buildings, and we don't want to have an asterisk next to it and say, what's it's a nice looking building for modular. I think this whole team's goal was to develop a new standard, and that new standard then would have to compete with all the other types of construction.
And just to make it a little more difficult than just the weather, we're also in a high hazard fire zone, because we're right at the edge of the campus, right up against the wilderness. So we had the facade has to withstand that as well.
This is Detailed, an original podcast by RCAT. I am your host, Charisse Lakeside, senior specification writer at RDH Building Science and fondly known as the CSI Kraken. We will speak with professionals who share their insights into the most complex, interesting, and odd building conditions and the ingenuity it took to make it work. Join me as I pull back the curtain on the building industry and uncover the lessons learned. You'll gain valuable knowledge to help you better navigate your next project. My guests today are Mike McCormick, Vice President of Facilities Management and Development at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, and David Hart, President and CEO of Steinberg Hart, and three guests today, Roger Krulak, Founder and President of Full Stack Modular. Mike is Vice President for Facilities Management and Development, a portfolio that includes capital planning, design, construction, inspections, energy and utilities, maintenance, custodial, landscape, fleet, real estate, and sustainability for a campus of over 23,000 students, 6 million square feet, and 10,000 acres. Mike has 40 years of experience in the industry and has been a pioneer in collaborative delivery methods and capital planning. Steinberg Hart is an architecture, interiors, and planning firm with 8 offices and a portfolio spanning higher education, residential, arts, hospitality, government, civic, and commercial markets. Leading with curiosity and passion, David ensures that the firm's values of design, relationships, and change remain central to its practice. Under David's leadership, Steinberg Hart has strengthened its national presence, expanded its reach, and reinforced its mission to shape spaces that enhance communities and improve lives. Roger Krulak is the founder and president of Full Stack Modular, an award-winning, pioneering company at the forefront of mid to high-rise modular construction. With an unwavering commitment to innovation and sustainable building practices for over 35 years, Roger's experience in the built world has transformed the construction industry with its progressive approach to design and manufacturing. Driven by his belief that modular construction holds the key to creating sustainable, affordable, and high-quality buildings, he is using advanced technologies to elevate modular construction within the industry. The project we're talking about today is the student housing program at Cal Poly, located in San Luis Obispo, California. But before we get started, don't forget to take a look at the project photos and drawings as you listen along. You can click the link in our show notes or visit www.rcat.com/podcast. Set against the coastal foothills of San Luis Obispo, Cal Poly's campus has long balanced its academic mission with the constraints of a tight regional housing market and limited land availability. As enrollment projections point toward thousands of additional students by decade's end, the university's challenge is not merely quantitative. It is fundamentally architectural. Mike McCormick and David Hart describe the program that adds 4,200 new beds in 9 residence halls organized around a suite-style typology.
At Cal Poly, we are fortunate enough to find ourselves in a position where we're turning away upwards of 40,000 students that are qualified to get into Cal Poly, just because we simply can't accommodate that. And as a state institution, that's not really what we're trying to do. It's bad for California that we're not able to do that. So we're trying to grow our enrollment slowly without sacrificing any of the kind of learn by doing that makes it so popular. But in order to do that, we have to look at housing, because we also are in a little tiny city that everybody else wants to live in too. And so our vacancy rate in the community is, you know, less than 2%, which is effectively nothing. And so for us to grow the student body, we have to house them on campus. And we also know, by the way, that students do much better. They're much more likely to succeed if they live on campus. And so we have a need to accommodate all the growth and as many students as we can to live on campus. So we kind of looked at our financial model. We said we can probably do about 4,000 beds on campus. We can probably support that financially. And so then we have to look at, okay, what's the best way to do that? That's about $1 billion worth of construction. And again, back to our little tiny town that we live in, to find enough contractors to simply do that is really, really difficult in a little tiny town, because we have $500 million of other construction happening on campus already. So we've pretty much already taken up the workforce. So we had to find a way to do this work without importing, you know, a bunch of workers that then have to live in the community, which exacerbates the problem that we're trying to solve, right? And so that's how we kind of focused on doing offsite construction. The other thing that we really hope to do is, with 4,000 units, we really hope to start to see some economies of scale and to drive down the cost of student housing. It's the biggest cost that students have. It's a higher cost than tuition is right now. And so we need to find ways to add the student housing without, you know, increasing the cost of the students and their ability to come to a Cal Poly.
So it's really a program rather than just a project. So it's made up of a series of buildings. And as a program, it means that we're measuring our ability to build new beds, design and build new beds, against our pro forma, so our financial model. And we are currently modeling around 3,600 new beds, which is right now all planned for being modular. That is using modular construction for all the new beds, looking at 3,600. And then we have another 1,200 beds of renovation on 6 old mid-century buildings that are still doing a good job for the campus for first years. And what we're building is really for second-year students and up. And so that's kind of the overall. And all told, I think we are at 22 acres, including the land where we're doing the renovation. So it's about 12 to 14 acres of new development and about 6 to 8 acres. I can't remember the exact amounts, but adds up to about 22 acres for the overall program, which is planned to be implemented over about a 8 to 10 year period. And we're about 2 years into that. And we're not able to take any beds offline through the course of the project, because I have to keep that revenue stream going and keep, as Mike was talking about, we need the beds so that Cal Poly can continue to grow its enrollment and serve the need that Mike just talked about.
In partnership with Full Stack Modular, the university is reshaping its approach to campus development by embracing the design, manufacture, construct, or DMC model. an industrialized process that shifts design thinking upstream and reframes construction as a form of precision fabrication.
DMC is design, manufacture, construct. So the idea is that, you know, seamlessly Cal Poly as owner, you know, Steinberg Hart as designer and full stack as manufacturer are creating an integrated product that delivers what it is that Mike and Cal Poly are trying to do in a way that is effective for the program that that David just described. So the interesting thing about building offsite, which I think is the correct term, is that the scope of what's happening on site and what's happening offsite can vary greatly. And as Mike described in his program earlier, the goal here, because of the lack of trades and even a place for the trades to stay, the idea is to make as much of the building, and in our case, sort of volumetrically, facade on, finishes done to the extent possible. And in order to do that, a number of things are required. The design has to match an opportunity to finish as much as possible. The program has to match that. And then obviously the pieces and parts, the sub-assemblies like facade, for example, that go into it, all have to be compatible with the idea of delivering as much finished as possible. And so the DMC, the D side of the DMC is, how do we get this to look the way that Cal Poly expects it to be? And then how do we take that scope and, to the extent possible, move it offsite?
By relying on a highly repeatable unit, the design team can refine spatial efficiency, acoustics, ventilation, and daylighting at a granular level before full-scale production begins. This prototype-first approach reflects a shift toward iterative architectural testing more commonly associated with advanced manufacturing than traditional construction.
What's interesting about designing for manufacturing is that your design is moving into production very quickly. So you're moving from that gap where normally you would have some mobilization, there's buyout, there's shop drawings, there's multiple reviews of the shop drawing, you know, all of the process that we're familiar with, that takes a long time. This process is collapsed, and we are going from design thinking to manufacturing very quickly. The other thing is it's a fully integrated team. Roger's team and our team and Mike's team and then the contractor, Whiting Turner, are all working in sync with each other to do it once. So the lean principles, basically, you know, to do it one time. And not everything works perfectly, particularly on the first building, but everybody's mindset is towards, we're going to get this right, and then we're going to repeat the repeatable elements of the building, you know, over and over again, and not go through the, what I would call just the traditional process of design, revisit, rethink, design, revisit, rethink. And because you can't rethink it, it's been built by now, and then it's on a truck, and then it's being shipped to the site. So it's very gratifying for those of us who've been working in design build for a long time, which is quite popular in California, where we're working in an integrated way with the builder. This is really taking it a step further because we're working with the manufacturer and are in fact integrated with the manufacturer's team. So it is different, but I think it's going to save time and eventually save money. And certainly it's safer. There's a whole lot of benefits to this particular process.
Are you familiar with I think it's called the McLeany curve, and it's a graph that shows that the effort that we put in and the value that it brings to the project is better if we shift it left on the graph. So it pushes a bunch of decisions, it pushes a bunch of effort to the beginning of the project. And I think this is really encapsulates that, because as David said, we have to decide on really small details early in the process, rather than trying to do that at the end where we're actually not bringing a ton of value to the project when we do it late.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the important things about what David said is that, you know, we have a system that allows buildings to be built, although that system is flexible and has design opportunity, et cetera. It also asks the design team to do something which is unusual, which is to share agency with the system. And that process of the integration that David mentioned is the value opportunity. And as Mike described, it's also the strain, right? Because so much has to be just lumped into the beginning of that process so that we can get economies of scale, you know, achieve the design intent, make sure the use is proper. And then what are the pieces and parts that are going into that in order to give you a finished building so we can get things cranking in the factory? So all of those things happen at the same time for Mike's comment about the curve. And we're asking the architects to say, hey, just think about the way these things go together because there's a value proposition with organizing the system in a way that's efficient.
While the buildings will read as permanent site-specific architecture once assembled, their origins are distinctly industrial and rely on highly precise systems to interface with the site.
The way that our system is organized, you can pretty much build whatever you want that can structurally accept whatever our, whatever the mass of our mods are and how they're connected. And there is a very specific system that allows that foundation, whatever type it is, to interface with the mods starting at the, you know, floor that they're attaching to. So that system requires just that there is a theoretical XYZ alignment at the point that the foundation or whatever's happening ahead of time, podium, etc., to receive the mods. And then once that's done, you can stack them. But the interface is very organized and specific to what is needed in order to get there. And obviously, the interesting thing is because we're building in a factory, and this is going to be geeky for you, because we're building in a factory, we are building in the factory to a theoretical, on a theoretical basis, right? Because we're actually not building on site. We're building in a factory that is supposed to approximate the drawings, which are theoretical, which David created. And then we turned to design for manufacture drawings. So the everything ultimately has to meet theoretical for the mod manufacturing offsite to really work. In contrast, if you have a conventional building, you don't have to exactly meet theoretical except for to whatever tolerance you're willing to accept in order to make it all to go together.
Well, and the tolerance is quite tight. I think Roger's leaving out the precision that is in this process. These are steel mods, and they're coming with the facade attached. And so you know the tolerance of a facade panel to facade panel on any building that would, say, have a panelized facade system. That tolerance is quite tight. And so we're dealing with placing large semi-sized boxes down with the same level of precision that we would place facade panels. So it's a very precise process compared to wood modular or other sort of I'll call them Lego block or panelized prefabricated systems. So it is a tight tolerance system.
I'll give an example. So as we're doing all of the utility work and all the foundation work, the contractor has a geospatial monitor that they put down. And so it's a, you know, three-dimensional laser scan to make sure that every anchor bolt is exactly the right place and every receiver for the mods is in exactly the right space. And it has to be exact, to David's point. So that, you know, we had to do a lot of moving things around because of that. But, you know, if we hadn't done that, we wouldn't be able to place the modules when they come on site.
With so many rotating partners on board the project, the permitting and contracting process reflects more of a design-build approach.
Well, technically, this is a design-build contract, and that's the statute that we're operating under. Now, the terms of the design-build contract will look exactly like an IPD project. And so what we created a contract that provides a framework for the entire program that David was talking about. And then we peel off project work authorizations within that overall contract framework for each building. So then that provides us with a contractual structure. And then from a procurement perspective, we procured it with that in mind, because we're going through one procurement process and for the entire program, yet you're not guaranteed to have the next project. That's always a decision that we all get to make, right? Because, you know, interest rates could skyrocket and we might have to stop the whole thing, or somebody doesn't perform well or whatever. But because we were able to procure the entire program, we did it on a completely on value-based decisions. So nobody's bidding. And we did that all the way down through the subcontractors for the entire program. And really all we're looking at is the overhead and profit rates, because that's all you can talk about at that point, because there's no project that has been defined. In terms of the IPD process, this is built just like an IPD contract, so that there are, I think, 12 risk reward partners that put their profit at risk based on the success of the project, of the overall project. And so that was pretty clearly articulated in the framework document. So everybody kind of knows what they're getting into there. That's kind of how we did that. It took us a full year to work through the contracts and the procurement process before we launched this. You know, with this scale of project, we knew we needed to do something different if we were going to do this kind of scale of project and also still try to drive the cost down. So we really wanted to approach it from a process perspective and spent the time up front.
Full Stack Modular will fabricate the units in a controlled Los Angeles factory where tolerances, material quality, and environmental conditions can be calibrated with a consistency impossible to achieve on a large construction site.
It's not where it ends, but it's where it starts. So not every system that goes into the building has the same tolerances. There's no, you know, this tolerance for plumbing and this tolerance for concrete and this tolerance for, it's all the same tolerances. And that's one of the major tolerance requirements is the envelope. How do you make sure that it is sustainably correct and also watertight? So our metrology system in the factory drives all of those things. At the same time, we have to put a designed facade on it. And that's sort of where the architect comes in, is what does that designed facade look like, feel like, respond to, act like, et cetera.
The facade it's an EFIS system, and it's built up the entire wall component. So you've got the metal studs, and then you have the framing for the EFIS system. It is not a soft foam though, because it's a like concrete, but it's basically a ceramic type finish on either side of that insulated panel. So it's really hard finish. And then it has a nice attractive drive-it finish troweled over the face of that. Those are manufactured in a shop not too far away from where the mods are. And then they're shipped over to the factory in Carson where the full stack modular is. And then they're placed onto the mod. The facade is attached onto the mod into the factory, and then it's shipped out to the field. It's all wrapped, you know, it's wrapped up in plastic, and then it gets craned into place and put down into that precise location. There's a brand name for it, but like an M seal that's peeled away, that then is one layer of seal, and then there will be a cosmetic then Baccarat and sealant that goes over the, it's more than cosmetic, but you basically have a double seal. There are other ways to do that with compression gaskets and other approaches, but this one is a little bit of belt and suspenders approach and has some control of the cosmetics at the end for that second seal that we are able to do. And so the insulation is in that SIP panel. That EFIS piece actually has a rigid insulation of, it's about 3 inches, actually. It's like about 3-inch insulated piece. So you've got that insulated panel on the outside there. And then the joints aren't much different, I should say, than you might see in a panelized facade system. We've done some things with the geometry to obscure those seams with shade and shadow and some dimensionality. We did have people who wanted to make it flat to save a few dollars. Mike McCormick said, absolutely not. Because, mean, I think that's one of the challenges is we still have to make really beautiful buildings, and we don't want to have an asterisk next to it and say, well, it's a nice looking building for modular. I think this whole team's goal was to develop a new standard, and that new standard then would have to compete with all the other types of construction.
And just to make it a little more difficult than just the weather, we're also in a high hazard fire zone because we're right at the edge of the campus, right up against the wilderness. So we had the facade has to withstand that as well.
Each suite, a 6-bed, 3-room module, becomes a fundamental architectural building block of the project.
If you come off of the hallway and into the unit, you come into a small living space. And in front of you is 3 bedrooms. And then you have a bathroom to your right and a bathroom to your left. And each bathroom has a sink, a shower, and a toilet. So the living space is a little bit of a transitional space for students, but there is enough room to be able to get a small couch and a television or a few study desks. There's a little bit of flexibility about how that space is used. And then once you get into the room, it's designed for the ability to have, the baseline is 2 beds in each one. So you've got 6 people living in this unit. There is the ability to add a 3rd bed to the rooms for periods of surge, like there's a big incoming class or we need more this semester or this year. So there's ability to accommodate that physically, but it's really designed for 6 students to live in that unit together. And every floor has a series of study spaces, and then it has a common space with a community kitchen. So every floor gets its own community space with its own community kitchen. And then down on the ground floor, there is a much larger space for everyone in the building, which is a larger social space that has some gaming areas. And then, of course, you have the laundry. You know, one of the big things that it's the big equalizer for students in their freshman or sophomore year is laundry. And that's adjacent to that big common space down on the ground floor. And then we are in an area with a wonderful climate, so that large space on the ground floor has sliding, nano wall. I guess for this audience, they'll know what that is, right? So some really nice indoor-outdoor space to take advantage of the wonderful climate along the Central Coast there.
All of this is designed around community sizes, right? So there's a community size on a per floor basis. There's a community size on a building basis. There's going to be a community size for the whole neighborhood. And so I think David's crew has done a fantastic job of designing community spaces for all of those various sizes of community so that the students will, you know, find a place to belong.
Architectural detailing, structural design, MEP distribution, and interior finishes must all be resolved early and with exceptional precision.
To the extent possible, it happens in a place that's easily accessible, you know, as close to the hallway as possible and as unitary as possible. And that's as possible because there's a wide range of things that work depending on the product and the environment and the time and the desire. So it's hard to say, you know, this or that. But the idea that one of the major sort of parameters that I mentioned earlier is you want it as close to the hallway as possible. You want it as vertical as possible. You want it as unitized as possible and still meet the MEP or electrical design needs that are required.
So is any of that actually done in the pods before it comes
yes.
to?
Yes, it's to the extent possible, as distributed as possible and as coordinated as possible. And that varies, you know, item per item. And we could spend lots of time talking about each one of them. But in general, the idea is to do as much as we can. So the vertical risers for plumbing, for example, are done. And the what we call mate line kits are shipped with it to do that, for example. But there are some electrical pieces that are sort of a little bit more done in the field because it doesn't make sense to do all of those segments. But and on and on and on. But the idea is, you have a lot of flexibility in type of system, but if you want to move the work offsite, it needs to be more unitary and more organized to a place that you have access, which hopefully is mostly in the hallway.
We're actually really excited about that from a maintenance perspective, right? So what that ends up doing is it ends up creating a building that's much more maintainable. And so where all of the verticals connect, that's in the corridors. We have a panel that we can pop off. We can get to all those connections. The unit, the HVAC unit, is in the rooms. And we even did a little drill that's a ceiling mounted. And so we even did a little drill of like, here's a lift. We have four bolts to unscrew. They can take the unit down. They can take it out in the hallway. They could put a new unit in. And we timed it just like a NASCAR pit stop, right? And so our maintenance guys are comfortable that they can get in and out of there very quickly. And that's the kind of thing that we wouldn't have thought about in traditional construction, I think.
In addition to targeting LEED Gold through recycled water systems and an expansive solar array, the project leverages modular construction's naturally low-waste methodology.
All of our projects are designed to a LEED Gold standard, as just a pure LEED standard. And then we are dealing with kind of some pretty significant infrastructures on an interesting basis based on the project itself. So it prompted us to consider a recycled water. So we're going to be recycling all of our sewage and using that for irrigation. And that takes our water usage down by more than 30%. We have a huge solar array going up because to help power the housing projects. And we're also ended up doing a big water infrastructure project that allows us to take our water at a much more steady pace rather than, kind of the kind of surges that would typically occur in a place like this. So there's a lot of the infrastructure that we emphasize on top of the LEED Gold.
Modular is inherently efficient as it relates to low waste, because you're ordering a whole bunch of materials and then deciding, cutting them as you go. So when you visit the factory, you already see that it's a low waste environment. So I don't know that we get as many LEED points for that, but it certainly is an important part of the process.
And truck traffic's about 70% down from conventional once you get past foundation. So that obviously truck traffic, et cetera, which is a big deal, especially where we're talking about, also has value.
Because the modular system relies on tightly controlled specifications, all design variations must be resolved and approved by the team and client early on, creating a unique design challenge that requires full alignment from all parties.
With this project, when you're doing the what we would call the room data sheets during programming, because we're putting all of the mechanical, electrical, we're solving all of that for the modular design with Roger. And so the clients, our room data sheets are down to the 16th of an inch. They're actually working drawings. They're not something that gets approved by the owner and then gets worked out down the way. So if you think about it, this unit that's being developed is going to be moving straight into manufacturing, but also then the owner approval. So the challenge is really around, you're sitting and looking at something once, maybe twice, third times, it's set. And in a normal design process, you have lots of opportunity to revisit and rethink and sort of, what else would be nice? It's sort of a feature add, I'll call it. You really don't have that here. So I think one of the big challenges with going in this direction is getting the owner to understand that this, yes, it may only be the fourth time you've seen us in a meeting, but this is it. We're going to be locking this down. And I think that is something that we all work together on. But I would say that for me anyway, as in the architect's seat, I saw that as a bigger challenge than, say, doing what was needed for Roger and his team. To me, I understood that path. It was the, how do we get the owner to understand that this is a final decision? Because it normally isn't at an early schematic/programming stage.
But I would also say that there was a pretty significant permitting challenge when the construction is done offsite, there's a different jurisdictions. We have an office of fire safety within the CSU, and then the state fire marshal is at the end the one that inspects it and says we can occupy it. And this is something they hadn't seen, right? And so we had to work through, spent over a year, again, working through who has jurisdiction and what has to be shown on the drawings. And we did a lot of fire testing of assemblies because people hadn't seen that. And so I think that was, we knew that was coming, but that was even bigger challenge, I think, than we expected.
Well, the AHJ conversation, as Mike mentioned, is very complicated because if the local jurisdiction isn't familiar and there are multitudes of who's in charge of permitting, who's in charge of inspection, and the fact that you take the HCD, Housing Community and Development, and move all mods out, then they all have to figure out a way to come back together. And that is very complicated. Unless they've done it before and then they don't think about it again. But this was new for them, really. So it's a brand new learning curve.
For Full Stack Modular and its partners, the project represents a milestone in construction flow, an opportunity to demonstrate how industrialized construction can deliver high-quality, cost-effective living environments for students while accelerating timelines and reducing risk.
It's really the precursor more than anything, organizing what's going to happen where, how, and when, combining a construction schedule with a manufacturing schedule, making sure that everything is happening congruently in a way that allows you to take advantages of the time savings and the economies of scale requires all those things up front. If those are all done up front, there's not a lot of sweat. If something is missed, and inevitably something's missed, but if something's missed, that's where the energy gets put as to how do we solve this problem because of the congruence between manufacturing and construction.
One of the really great opportunities on this is it requires us to manage flow of the work in a way that you don't do in a traditional construction process. You just don't have to in a normal construction process. But as the modules are coming out of the factory, they get on a truck, they come up here. We only have so much room to store them up on site before they get placed into the building. And so that whole flow, to Roger's point, takes a lot of pre-planning and a lot of eyes on it throughout the process. And I think that's good for the industry, actually. We would all learn a lot from that, managing the flow. Our scheduling software is not set up for that. Our processes aren't set up for that. Nobody really is in charge of the flow of materials in the way that we need it to be on a project like this.
The collaboration behind this effort is notable not only for its technical innovation, but also for its alignment around mission. As it relates to this project, the phrase, too many cooks in the kitchen, has evolved and expanded.
12 parties' profit is at risk of this going well, right? And so everybody has a high need to make sure that we're doing this as efficiently as possible, right? And so when you get that kind of motivation behind everybody, the next thing you do is just have to set some structure up, right? And so there's a whole series of meetings that the project management team meets on a daily basis. The senior management team meets on a weekly basis. There's an executive committee that makes decisions on a monthly basis. We meet with the entire subcontractor pool as an owner. We do that on a monthly basis. So there's a lot of those kind of communications that happen to make sure that we're not getting out of alignment. Because that's where you really start to have the misses, is when people lose track of what's important and what's coming at them.
I think what's important to recognize is that one of the things when you're moving so fast is that you have to find a way to prioritize everything in the right order. Everybody's smiling because that's a big ask. Like, is it most important that we get economies of scale and we build the buildings fast and they're all the same? Or is it most important that you have a variety of, solutions for the different users? Or is it most important that we get in on site at exactly the date we need it? Or is it, and how do you tease out how to prioritize them is the big opportunity and the very complicated task. And you do that right, and you know, it's like putting your, you know, golf ball on the tee correctly, and you know, and positioning yourself in the right place and taking a swing. Like, that's the most important thing. And then after that, things aren't so hard to tweak, but that's a big ask. And you always have to weigh, because things are going to clash with each other. So you always have to weigh, like, here's the opportunities, here's the costs. What are we doing based on this conflict of decisions? That's a biggie.
Charisse, at the risk of over answering, you started by saying, you know, multiple cooks in the kitchen, right? Let me give you a different picture. Multiple kitchens is where we began. And then it's really a matter of inviting people into your kitchen and then going to their, we had to do some rapid learning about the way different people not just work, but just fundamentally think about the process. And the reason we had to do that is we're doing things that would be a strain for a private developer to undertake. And we're doing it then with an institutional client, then within all the requirements of the CSU system, one of which we touched on, which is the Office of Fire Safety, the jurisdiction, one of the jurisdictions having authority. But when you put all that together, you've got people in their individual kitchens, and we needed to figure out how to get them out of their individual kitchens and into a room and in a space. But then we realized that wasn't enough. We need to invite them into our different areas of deep knowledge and expertise. And then once we understood more about what was in their head, then I feel like we really were able to start moving forward. That took some time. And yeah, it was the classic, you know, we're building the plane as we fly the plane because of the schedule that we were, the need for beds, we were moving very quickly.
By 2030, when the full program is complete, Cal Poly's modular housing initiative will stand as a case study in architectural adaptation, an exploration of how precision manufacturing, thoughtful planning, and a reimagined construction workflow can converge to reshape the future of student living. Before we close out this episode, I always try to gain some additional insight from our guests about the greater industry. I was curious what Mike, David, and Roger thought are some of the bigger issues that public agencies are facing right now when trying to do a new project.
I always call it the owner's dilemma, and that's a book that a friend of mine, Barbara Bryson, wrote that I would highly recommend. But it is that the things that we as public owners need is more efficient processes, and we have to address the cost of construction. We have a housing crisis because construction costs so much. Our infrastructure is failing because construction costs so much. I mean, the cost is preventing us from taking care of our built environment the way we need to. And the irony is that we, the public owners especially, have created the system that costs so much. And by that, I mean the contracts, all of the requirements, the way we pass risk down to our supposed partners, the way they then pass risk down to others, the checks and balances that we put in place that, you know, seemingly for all good purposes, are all of the things that drive the cost of construction up. And there's quite a bit of research done, and these are, you know, like tens of percentage points of cost that we're adding to the cost just because we have these rigorous processes. And it's so the dilemma is we want lower cost construction, but then the market can't deliver it because we're not really asking for it. And the market has evolved to get used to the processes that we ask. You know, David's description of the design process and the feedback loop that he gets is a perfect example of that, right? He's used to that. We can say, no, that's not the process we're going to do. But that's how his whole firm is set up, right? So they still do that. And so the same is true on the construction side. So, you know, like I said, we're our own worst enemy. We've created this system that inflates the cost. And we have to start deconstructing that pretty quickly.
Yeah, I think it's in terms of wanting, let's say, lower cost or innovation or something new, but not being willing to change your processes and thinking that we're going to hire people who've done this or have this skill set, and somehow by hiring the team or the consultants, we're done. And now if we can, via expectations, we will have some new outcome. And I it's much harder work, and you really do have to fundamentally change the way you work to be able to arrive at a different outcome. And so I tend to find that what we're generally see is Band-Aids or little, what end up being novelty rather than innovation, because that's the extent to which our risk tolerance or our ability to change the way we work is. And I think we're on the precipice of, as an industry, of needing for our existence, for our success, to truly innovate and move beyond what I'll call sort of accumulation of novelties in place of true innovation. And the public sector needs to lead the way. I'll say one more thing. I don't think it's the sort of thing where the public sector waits for the private sector to do something and then adopt it. Some of what we're need to do in our industry needs the backing, the support, the leadership of big public institutions for us to make these changes. I don't think it's going to happen from development or a private sector, personally.
So I will look at the same question a little bit differently, but along the same lines. So to me, there's two major areas that I think, and Mike mentioned one of them, which is that public procurement, et cetera, does need adjustment, as does permitting. We've already mentioned some of those constraints, et cetera. And that requires a good redesign. And, you know, Cal Poly has tried to do that sort of using this system. And I think that that is incumbent if you're going to get any efficiency to deal with the housing crisis specifically. And then on the other side is speed and capacity constraints. So velocity and capacity are two things that the industry, after the mortgage crisis of 2007, sort of shrunk at a risk basis. And it has never, and it probably will never, I don't know, I hope it does, but it will never catch up. So you have this capacity and velocity constraint on one side, and then you have, even if you could get it moving fast enough, you have to get it approved and you have to get it designed and procured appropriately. So those are the places we can collectively improve, public, private. And without that, it's going to be hard to move the needle.
I really enjoyed this conversation with Mike, David, and Roger. I hope this episode sparks a new idea, helps you solve a problem that you've been working through, or inspires the mark that you want to leave on this world.
We have a little saying in the firm that we want our projects to do more than solve a problem or just address a need. That what we're really striving to do is create a memorable place that helps foster community, sense of belonging. And when we're doing the very best of our work, I would say it even inspires people. And I think that's really what we're trying to do in terms of making the world better is just, we still need beautiful things. We need things that inspire us and make us think twice and look at the way the light is hitting that. And, oh, that was unexpected, that moment of levity or surprise. And I think as we become more and more of a place with AI, with predictive outcomes and a little bit of an answer society where there's a question, we pick this thing up and ask it what the answer is, that these other more sort of subjective, nuanced elements are really important aspects to have in our life. And I think that is part of leaving some breadcrumbs to for others to find and be inspired.
I have been on a journey and quest simultaneously for the past 15 or so years to change the way that we create the built environment specifically for housing. And my hope is that the legacy is that the solution that I have been pushing for and towards has an effect on the housing needs and capacity for this country and other places, not only this country, but it's an insatiable need, at least for the near future, and trying to chip away at capacity and velocity is really with something that is high quality, that doesn't look modular the way you said, so that it is high quality housing for the appropriate use and taking advantage of the economies of scale that industrialization offers.
This is why we get along so well, is we all are kind of, you know, revolutionaries in some ways. Like there's a belief that the built environment really matters, right? And I think we all share that. And so my hope is that it's not just us. My hope is that we have a lot more people thinking about process and how we build these things in a very different way, in a very open-minded way, that we can start to get over this position that we're in now, right? Which is, it's the built environment is just costing too much, and it is the solution to many of the problems that we're having as a culture right now. Is if we can just, build our way and find more efficient ways to build it, we can solve a lot of the problems: sustainability, housing, infrastructure. The list goes on and on, right? But we can't do it unless we have people that are willing to really rethink the process. And that's my hope. And so Cal Poly is one of the best architecture schools in the country, with highly sought after graduates. We spend a lot of time over there talking about this project and trying to get the students to say, no, there are different ways to do things. And we really want you to see this and be exposed to this. This is right in your backyard. So you really should take stock in this. And so we're, it's more of a kind of mission to advocate much more broadly than just just the success of the project itself.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more, visit rcat.com/podcast to see photos, details, and more related project and product information that we discussed today. While you're there, take a look around rcat.com. For over 30 years, RCAT has been the resource for AEC professionals to find the right products for their project. Try RCAT and see how their tools can save you time and money and help you get ahead on your next project. Visit rcat.com. That's ARCAT.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can support us by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and sharing this with your friends. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back to share more stories and lessons learned to help you navigate your next project.